Business and Consumer Affairs Committee meeting, June 13th.
And Business and Consumer Affairs will come to order. Clerk will note those members present. The hearing that we're going to have today on Senate Bill 570 is primarily informational only to the members of the committee, and to get them a background, or to give them a background of 570 and also the amendments that were made to 570 in the Senate, and questions about, general questions about LCDC policy. We have experts in the audience that would be able to testify to that effect or answer questions. I have the first person scheduled is Fred Renau, and he's the counsel of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee. Where is he? There he is. Okay. I think I'll call him up at a later time.
Yes, they don't have to.
Fine.
Chairman?
Yes.
In view of the lack of enthusiasm in people that are more environmentally oriented than I, maybe the battle's already over and we're wasting our time here. Is 2681 going to come out on the floor and pass?
Well, it's my understanding that 2681 will be on the floor today, that there's a possibility of a motion to defer it to time certain, and it's my understanding that that motion will probably be supported by a large number of members of the House.
You don't feel we're literally spinning our wheels here, then?
No, I don't, Representative Markham.
I could think of better things to do this afternoon.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Fred Ronald, legal counsel for the Senate Environment and Energy Committee, here upon request of your committee. I'm open to suggestions if you want me to quickly run through the bill. I think I could do that in about 10 minutes.
Okay, I think that'd probably be the best way to proceed.
You presently have Senate Bill 570, is that correct?
That's correct.
I think the pages are identical with 2681 and line, so either bill would work.
Unbelievable.
In the relating clause on page 3, the most important thing to note would be the repeal of the ORS Chapter 191 section. These refer to the Oregon Coastal Conservation and Development Commission's creation and duties, which statutorily expired by 1975 when they were supposed to create a comprehensive plan. From testimony before our committee, they do not serve a function any longer and therefore were repealed. The provisions repealed in ORS Chapter 215 are old Senate Bill 10 from 1969, and they allowed originally the governor and then the Land Conservation Development Commission presently to come in and zone unzoned lands within a county. Those sections have also been repealed in lieu of the new enforcement provision in Senate Bill 570. On line 30 of page 3, there is a change that can be discussed rather quickly, and it basically is a housekeeping measure that reflects a general concept carried throughout the bill that goals and areas of critical state concern and activities of statewide significance should be treated conceptually different. In the bill, goals are general, and activities and area provisions have been expanded so that they will be able to be used to treat specific problem areas throughout the state. In lieu of that, the wording regarding goals and guidelines was taken out of subsection 5 in state regulations.
Can we ask questions?
Yes.
Do the goals and guidelines then, do they then become, quote, state regulations? Is this just another name for the same breed of pup?
Yes and no. Goals are not labeled as either rules or something else. In the current law, the introductory phrase to the Senate Bill, intent statement in the original Senate Bill 100 stated that the legislature specifically declined to label what goals were. There's an Attorney General's opinion that, not Attorney General's opinion, but writings by an existing Attorney General that probably follows the legal, correct legal interpretation in that they are rules pursuant to ORS Chapter 183.310, the definition of rules.
Matter of fact, Mr. Renaud, wasn't there a request, as I recall, Legislative Council Committee requested from the Attorney General's office back about a year ago whether or not goals were rules? I believe the answer at that time from the Attorney General was that yes, they are.
I'm unaware of that, but that would be my opinion.
Mr. Herman is here, and later, Mr. Herman, of course, you can answer that question now if you would. If you would.
Herman just said, we did not, on page 4, line 21, we did not attempt in the Senate to define the concept of goals in the definition section, but only stated that it means the mandatory statewide planning standards adopted by the commission. If you would turn to page 11, the concept of goals is expanded. On section 17, line 29, is the opted section by which the Land Conservation and Development Commission adopts goals. And on the next pages, you will find the changes made in Senate Bill 570, the first of which is a requirement of a statewide need, a requirement of flexibility, and a requirement that they not be specific regulations for specific areas or for specific activities. Returning to page 4, the next definition is guidelines. The concept of guidelines was amended to make them only suggested approaches and not mandatory, the rationale being that how you get there is not as important as getting there. In line with the definition of making guidelines suggested approaches, the word guideline was deleted throughout Chapter 197 wherever it was used in a mandatory sense. So wherever in existing laws there was a statement that you have to comply with guidelines, guidelines was deleted.
All right. If I was to ask where I might find a list or a copy of these guidelines, where would I look?
I would look in the Oregon Administrative Rules, and they should direct you to the location of LCDC publications that contain the guidelines. They are in the Senate Joint, excuse me, they are not. I was thinking of gold, but that's how I would find the guidelines. On Section 3, on page 5, the Senate Bill 570 makes several amendments to the commission itself. The notable ones are that the members must reflect the geographic and occupational makeup of the state, and at least one member must be an elected city or county official. In line with that, in Section 4, there is a provision delaying the effective date of commission membership requirements until 1979, and that is to preserve existing commission members so they can be reappointed.
Can I ask one question back on guidelines? Prior to the consideration of this bill, were guidelines being considered as rules by LCDC?
I really wouldn't want to try to answer that question. I know that they require justification for deviation from guidelines,
which in effect made them rules.
I really have no answer to that question. Someone else in the audience. On line 20, section 4A, in order to get a local official upon the commission, there's a temporary 8th position on the commission created, which will expire when a local city or county official is appointed pursuant to regular procedures or 1979. On the bottom of page 5, there is a cooperation section which requires the LCDC to design and tailor its administrative requirements to meet the local capacity of cities and counties.
You've got two communities. You've got the little community of, say, Talon, Oregon, which has, quote, a planning capacity, and you have the city of Portland. They simply don't have the resources to approach the issue of planning with the same thrust or the same effort. Is that what this reference is talking to? You have to consider the capability of the local community or county and its resources available for planning?
I don't want to try to discern the intent of the people that propose this amendment, but from reading the words, I would say, yes, that's exactly what it is attempting to get at. On page 6, line 12, there's a housekeeping amendment. And on line 19, the original law required the LCDC to prepare model zoning, subdivision, and other ordinances. In Senate Bill 570, this provision is moved from that section up to page 7, line 5, which makes it not a mandatory function any longer. Section 7 is another cooperation between local cities and counties and the state, and it requires the appointment of a local officials advisory committee to advise the commission. The next major amendment is on page 8, section 12, line 16. It requires cities and counties in annexing unincorporated territory to consider goals. This provision, in essence, overrules the case of Peterson versus Klamath Falls, a court of appeals case that has since been argued before the Supreme Court, and there's no decision yet down from the Supreme Court on that issue. Section 13 on line 29 of page 8, and following on page 9, attempts to put state agencies in the same boat with cities and counties. In other words, they must prepare copies of their rules, their programs, and a program of coordination with cities and counties, and a program of technical assistance of cities and counties, and submit them to the LCDC for approval. The penalty if a state agency does not get an accepted plan is located in section 16, page 10, and they are prohibited from contesting a city or county when they apply for compliance if the agency itself is not in compliance. Section 14 once again includes the annexation issue and also requires special districts to make sure that their plans and programs are in compliance with goals, and in the case of special districts, the counties rather than the LCDC are assigned the coordinative function. On page 10, section 16 is located the penalty if a state agency or special district does not submit their programs to either the LCDC or the counties.
Mr. Chairman, what are the penalties, please?
The penalty is that a state agency or special district could not enter into a LCDC hearing on a city or county request for compliance. In other words, when a city or county goes to the LCDC and says, all our stuff is in order, we want to be ruled in compliance. If a state agency or district had not done their work with that local entity and been approved by LCDC, their program is accessible, they could not contest that city or county. Correct. They could not enter into the proceedings.
Representative Morris.
The Department of Transportation has come up with a 6-year plan for reconstruction and construction of highways. They're going to have to then go back and re-examine that document in light of the goals. Is that correct statement?
Well, theoretically, they shouldn't, because theoretically, that their plan should be in compliance under existing law with the basic statewide goal. If the LCDC determined that they were completely out of whack with goals, the penalty would be that they could not contest the city or county when they tried to make the compliance.
Mr. Chairman,
Yes, Ruth Penny Markham.
This reference to the city of Portland, if you will, on line 9, what's the need of that?
What page?
10. Looks like the opt-out town over 300,000, you want to call it a town.
Oh, that's an existing law, Representative, and that refers to, I think, Craig specifically.
Jeff, you know what? You know why that was put in there?
Go ahead, Jeff.
This is Jeff Kleinman, and he was the counsel to the Land Use Committee.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's in there to limit the coordinating powers of Multnomah County over the city of Portland specifically.
I see.
Whatever that means.
Well,
you want to try again, Bill?
I can explain that further.
Tell me a picture, will you, please?
Okay. Under Senate Bill 100, as it came out in 1973, I guess most people feel that the counties were given some functions beyond those of cities, including the coordination of all cities within their boundaries for planning purposes. And I guess it was felt that Multnomah County, well, that Portland essentially swallowed up Multnomah County in terms of planning responsibilities, and that Multnomah County should not go ahead on its own and coordinate Portland on the same basis as Wood Village and Gresham and Orient and other places.
Thank you.
Go ahead, Frank.
On page 11, line 13, section 16A, is a two-year moratorium on the adoption of new goals. This moratorium coincides with a moratorium adopted by the LCDC itself. The moratorium provides that goals may be revised if certain requirements are met, and that revisions and goals will have to be submitted to the Joint Legislative Land Use Committee. Section 17, line 29 on page 11 through line 22 on page 12 is the amendments to the goal concept that I discussed earlier. Line 23, section 18, is a grandfather provision to protect existing goals already adopted so that the amendments to the goal concept in section 17 will not affect existing administrative action. Section 20.
Can I go to section 19?
Sure.
Is section 19 the language that we should look at in the issue of the application of the goals to the individual planning actions of a community?
Yes, Representative Moore.
In light of the LCDC memo last week?
This would probably be the best section in existing law if you were going to work on action.
Can you define this language and those actions of the LCDC to determine exactly what we're talking about on this issue?
What we're talking about by actions?
Mm-hmm. And the application of goals?
Actions is not defined anywhere in the current law. I would venture to say that the thrust of the existing law, when you use the word actions, you would have to encompass just about everything. Building permits, as long as there was some discretion involved, variances, conditional use exceptions, anything of quasi-judicial nature would be covered under the term action.
If those actions are in compliance with the evolving comprehensive plan, there should be no problem. Is that a correct statement?
That's an open question. There are statutory references in RS Chapter 197 that say that goals are for comprehensive plans or not for actions. There's other statutes, RS 197, 175, 197-300, they imply that you can test goals against actions. There's been a recent Attorney General's opinion that said in a specific case where a goal required an inventory, you couldn't really test that against an individual, what we would call an action. The question was specifically left open if there was a concrete goal that could be applied in an individual instance. Some of the terms and some of the concepts of the recent LCDC memorandum imply that goals can be, actions can be tested against goals. It's mostly an interim problem.
That's right. In other words, once the comp plan is adopted, the goals upon petition to the LCDC could only be measured against the comp plan rather than the individual action. Is that a correct statement?
That would be a fair statement there, but there would be people who argued in an exceptional case, even after you have a comprehensive plan that's been acknowledged as in compliance with the goals, that you still could maybe test an individual action against.
Because we have so few adopted comp plans, we really haven't any court cases to help resolve this issue. Is that
correct?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Markham.
I'd like to ask this gentleman, line 7, page 12, could you give me the criteria for an outstanding scenic area?
Criteria for no, I cannot, Representative. That's existing law, and those are factors that are supposed to be considered.
Where would I find the law, if I may ask?
Wilderness, recreational, and outstanding scenic areas. I don't think you can find existing statutes on such things. But
I thought you said it was in the statute.
This is not an amendment. It was in existing law, 1973, Senate Bill 100.
I understand that, but I'm just asking, can you help me or not?
I would say that that's an administrative determination made by the LCD.
Then it's not in the law.
There are specific provisions for designation of things close to wilderness, recreational, and outstanding scenic areas in other places in existing law. Off the top of my head, scenic rivers or the river laws, rogue river area, that is one system. There's federal laws that deal with that. There is provision for the designation of unique wilderness areas in, I can't remember the correct ORS citation, but there is existing law around that. Section 20, line 34, page 12, is an expansion on one sentence in the existing takeover provisions in ORS 197325. Section 20 sets up a system by which a city or county can officially apply to the LCDC to get an order acknowledging that their comprehensive plan, implementing ordinances, and zoning ordinances are in compliance with the goals. Subsection 1 of Section 20 puts a limit on time by which the LCDC must make the determination. And on line 11 says that if the LCDC doesn't act, compliance will be granted.
Can I ask a question of staff?
Go ahead, Brad.
We have got in this bill several different examples of mandated time frames with which actions have to operate within. Could you have a chart drawn up, just a little chart, to show us what those time frames are for those different actions so I can try and straighten them out in my own mind?
Subsection 2 of Section 20 on line 12 provides for planning extensions. The city or county could request for a planning extension, and through that request, a compliance schedule would be developed. Subparagraphs A and B list what can be included in a compliance schedule. The thrust of paragraphs A and B is that compliance schedule is somewhat of a bilateral agreement between the LCDC and the cities or counties.
Do we have an open end for when we must have adopted comp plans for the state of Oregon, or is there an alleged date in which it's to be allowed?
There were dates in the initial law when the goals had to be adopted and provisions saying that you had to have your comprehensive plan in compliance a year after.
Well, I know that's passed, but my question now is, have we...
I do not know of an administrative rule. The LCDC might, but I think it's on an ad hoc basis.
It's still open-ended trying to bring them into compliance.
As far as I know.
Jeff, maybe you could answer that.
Yeah, it is open-ended, and the standard deadline is around 1979-1980 for most places.
About 2.5 years away, somewhere around 2 to 3 years away.
Yeah, at the end of the last session, when LCDC received full funding for local government planning, it was estimated that the planning process would take 10 years instead of the one that was envisioned in 73. But then when they started granting extensions, it began to look much more like a five-year process.
Does it look, is the best estimate that we will achieve this 1979 or 1980?
I would say 1980-1981, definitely.
On page 14, line 1, there's a provision for temporary extensions of compliance schedule.
Is there anybody that's not on a compliance schedule?
I just asked that question of Mr. Gustafson from LCDC, and he approximated 9 or 10 out of 278 planning jurisdictions for cities and counties in CRAG that are not on extension.
In other words, they basically haven't even started yet, or they're so far ahead, or what?
They would, by law, have to be on temporary extensions, which means they're working on getting a compliance schedule approved by LCDC.
So we don't have
any... Or their plans been approved?
I think that's 9 or 10 that don't have plans approved either.
So everybody, most everyone is at least cranked up and started the process.
Go ahead.
Section 22, ORS 197-300, is the existing section dealing with administrative appeals to the LCDC. The amendments made in Senate Bill 570 are basically housekeeping. Senate Bill 570 does not expand citizens' appeals. On page 15, subsection 3, there is a provision that limits dual filing in both the LCDC and the courts.
Was the question of due process raised when this was the amendment was approved?
Due process to who?
Denying someone an opportunity to, forcing an individual to pick and choose his route of appeal.
I don't think that due process would be involved, being that even if you go through an administrative proceeding, you still have a court remedy on appeal. So I don't think there's a due process issue.
This basically says you can't do the both at the same time?
It says you have your choice. If you only on goal questions, if you file in both, the latter will be stricken.
But so if I file one and I lose it, am I precluded from filing through the court?
You would not be specifically precluded by this amendment or existing law, but you would be probably precluded by legal doctrines of collateral estoppel or res judicata. Section 23 and the preceding few sections deal with the administrative procedures of the LCDC in their appeals process. On line 14, on page 15, there is a provision that limits the LCDC's activity on an appeal to the record.
This should be an attractive amendment for a lot of people, I would assume, because the supposition route or whatever could not be made. It'd have to be made on the statement of fact. Is that a correct interpretation?
If you're saying that the issues have to be raised below.
The issues from the LCDC viewpoint have to be raised on the statement of fact from that particular hearing.
Right.
And not upon suppositions or theories.
Right. It has to be based on...
And this, I would think, would be an attractive amendment for cities and counties, for example. Is that correct?
I'm not a city or county. I wouldn't.
I was just curious if there had been.
It would limit review to the record. And it would require, if there was substantial evidence in the record, that they would have to abide by the factual determinations. That's sort of a. Probably would have been required anyway. Section 24, line 31 on page 15, requires the LCDC to state whether it has jurisdiction over an appeal within 45 days, unless it doesn't have a regularly scheduled meeting, and then they're limited to their next meeting. Subsection 3, lines 12 through 19, limit the time with which the LCDC must come to a determination on an administrative appeal to 90 days, unless all parties agree. On page 18, the section 28, ORS 197405 is expanded in view of the change in the goal concept to set forth requirements that the commission must follow in designating and controlling activities of statewide significance, and in subsection 2 on line 22, in designating and regulating areas of critical state concern. These requirements are an expansion on portions of Senate Bill 100 that were not developed in the original legislation. The important thing to note is on page 19, line 16, where it states that no designation of an area or an activity will be effective until approved by the Legislative Assembly.
The Legislative Committee cannot acquiesce its responsibility under this provision. In other words, no action will be taken unless there's positive action by the Legislative Committee.
I don't believe it says that, but it does require them to submit their programs regarding activities and areas through the committee.
If it was alleged that the committee after the 73 session really abdicated its responsibilities on the issue of land use planning, and am I correct that this would strengthen it, that there has to be a positive action by that committee? Or
no, there would not have to be positive action. The words say no proposed designation under subsection 1 or 2, i.e. activities or areas, shall take effect unless it has first been submitted to the committee under subsection 4.
It takes approval of the assembly, not just the committee, then. Is that correct?
That's correct. On lines 23 through 25 on page 19 is an addition to existing law to clarify that areas of critical state concern are regulated by state regulation. Section 34 is the next optative section. This is the enforcement mechanism that was proposed in lieu of the provisions in ORS 197325 to call for a takeover and withholding of cigarette and liquor revenues. Under this system in Section 34, if the Land Conservation and Development Commission finds there is good cause to believe that any of the factors listed on page 22 in lines 1, 4, 7, 9, 11 have occurred or are occurring, they may issue an order to a local city or county directing them to bring certain parts of their land use planning into compliance with goals. Specifically, those two factors first, that the comprehensive plan or zoning ordinance is not in conformity a city or county is not making satisfactory progress under a compliance schedule to bring their plants into conformity. The order that's issued by the LCDC would have to state the nature of the compliance, the specific lands, if any, which the order is directed at, and the actual corrective action that would have to be taken by the local city or county to bring their land use plan into compliance. If a hearing is requested, the LCDC is required by subsection 3 to have a hearing on their order. After the hearing is over, an aggrieved party, city or county, could appeal, or the LCDC could appeal to the court pursuant to regular appellate procedure. Subsection 4 on line 19, page 23, provides for a moratorium. And subsection 5 is the enforcement powers. The LCDC would have to go to a circuit court and enforce the order. Section 37 on page 24 and the following sections are a notice provision that in essence requires that notice be given by mail, not registered, but by regular mail to anyone whose land will be rezoned due to changes in a comprehensive plan or whose land is rezoned.
Why wasn't this language put in for the cities also?
I have no answer to that question. This language only applies to counties.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Section 38 is a proviso that limits the notice provisions by the availability of money through the LCDC. Section 40 appropriates money for the notice provision. And that's based for the act, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Renault. Questions?
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Markham.
What is the penalty on page 22 or 3 for what gives you the state the right to withhold cigarette and gas tax?
That's an existing law, Representative Markham.
I'm going to make reference to it here.
The statute's been repealed. It's not in the bill. It's 197.325.
Have a copy.
The penalty would be that the LCDC would have to go through a local circuit court and enforce an order requiring the city or county to bring their plans, ordinances into compliance.
So then they'd go under subject of fine or whatever jurisdiction the circuit judge.
That's correct. I don't think it would be a fine.
Would that open another can of worms? What if you got a judge that's sympathetic to rural areas that isn't all that eager?
The judge would not have too much discretion because it would probably come down from a higher court on appeal.
I mean, if LCDC didn't like what the judge offered, they'd appeal it to the Court of Appeals. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the process, I guess I should go through the process again. LCDC would find a city or county not in compliance or not making satisfactory progress. They would issue an order saying do X.
Mm-hmm. The city said forget it or did nothing, then where are we?
Okay, then the LCDC would have a hearing if the city requested one. If they did not, there would be none. If there was a hearing, the city or county could appeal to the court. If there was none, the LCDC would go to the local circuit court to enforce the order. And I would venture to say that they would do that by direct request to that city or county. And if they did not act, they would be in contempt, or the court would have to put a moratorium on building permits or whatever else it felt necessary to enforce that LCDC order.
But if the judge just didn't offer an opinion that satisfied LCDC, just appeal his verdict to the Court of Appeals across the street. Is that what you're saying?
I would venture to say if the circuit court did not enforce the order, then you would have to appeal that determination once again to the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Further questions? Well, questions to Mr. Kleinman in regards to any background information that any of you need, not only in relationship to 570, but how Senate Bill 100 currently works. Representative Moore.
So am I correct that the two issues, principal issues that we probably will be facing from the witnesses, will be the issue of annexation and the issue of applying goals to individual actions?
That would be a correct statement, I'm sure.
Is there any additional areas in your judgment that you see as being substantive?
Areas of what?
Well,
disagreements?
Yeah. These are two principal areas that we'll be dealing with.
Those are two principal areas of disagreement. There's other areas of disagreement.
I know that, I'm sure.
Probably, if I was to venture to guess, I'd say one might be some sort of legislative approval goal. And the other issue from the other side would be an expansion of citizens' appeals. Those are probably two.
Didn't we put in here, isn't that, didn't you just go through that, to any new goals have to go through the legislative process?
Okay. No, new goals do not. There's just a moratorium on the adoption of new goals.
What was that section you were talking about where we were going through the...
Those are regulations for areas of critical state concern and activities of statewide significance.
Well, and if you wanted to get down to a time schedule, we've got a moratorium on new goals until, what, 1979?
You have 19 now, though. So
well, I know. You'd ask yourself how many more could you have. But if you got a moratorium until 1979, this issue could easily be addressed by the next session.
Legislative approval of goals, yes,
right.
It could.
Yeah.
Right. In fact, it's set up almost that it could be.
Yeah, it's not imperative that we would address it this session.
I don't know what's imperative.
It's odd if you've been through 19 hearings on the Senate floor.
Sounds like
you
may have put in financial
shit. Good chairman. Yes, Representative.
Page 19, section 5. Would you run me through that again slowly?
Yeah.
I can assure you I don't know what subsections 1 and 2 say either. So if you can explain that paragraph, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. I was here to talk about some of the genesis of the amendments that are in the bill.
Should I start on line 4, page 18?
That'd be fine.
There are certain activities of statewide significance that have already been designated by the legislature. If you turn the page over to page 17 on the bottom, there are a list of three. Public transportation facilities, public sewerage, planning and siting of public schools. LCDC presently could designate one of those right now for state regulation as an activity of statewide significance. They have not done so.
They could tell local school districts where to put their next high school, is that what you're suggesting? Or the law says, I should say.
They could require a permit for the site.
Well, you could.
But they couldn't cite it themselves.
Oh, I got another one.
Is there a difference, really?
I think.
Okay. 197405 on page 18 allows the LCDC to designate or pick out other activities of statewide significance that they think should be put under state regulation and permit. What they have to say to justify these activities as being of statewide significance is listed in the new language in A, B, C, and D. Once they do that, they have to submit it to the committee, and there has to be final legislative approval in subsection 5.
That means that the next subsequent session, the legislature has to ratify it?
That's correct. if the legislature doesn't ratify it, then those will not be activities of statewide scheme. That was implicit in the original law of 1973 also. The bottom of page 18, subsection 2, A, B, C, D, and E, is the same process for areas of critical state concern.
Any further questions? Thank you, sir. Jeff, why don't you stay there just a second? I'm going to call Steve Hawes up now. And I think it might be appropriate then at this time, the questions about the genesis of the amendments themselves and some of the remaining issues in regards to those. And Steve's consented to that. And then I think, Jeff, some of the questions then may be bounced back to you in regard to the position of the LCDC.
I'd like to answer one question that was raised, and I don't think it was answered, and that was the past status and treatment of guidelines and whether they've been treated as rules or not. And I think the answer to that is simply no. And although the guidelines were given more credence by LCDC than many local governments like, by their being required to explain deviations from the guidelines. They were never treated as having been adopted rules to which the local government had to conform. They did have to explain departures.
Jeff, what impact, if any, did the recent federal district court decisions have on that process? Did that impact in Oregon?
I'm not sure what decisions you're referring to.
As I recall, there was some federal district court decisions indicating that if you had a plan and guideline kind of system, that you had essentially to implement both of them.
That would not apply in Oregon. Plan, guideline, goal, they're all terms of art, and they're not the same everywhere. Whatever you establish as a definition of each of those things, in your state statute that determines how they apply.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I could just remain open to questions, or I can go through your administrative assistant's list of amendments for you if you'd like very briefly.
I think Representative Achilles has a question first that he'd like to pose to you.
Well, not so much a question, but as a suggestion that I would proceed.
All right.
The Chairman spoke earlier of addressing ourselves to the main amendments within Senate Bill 570 and giving us some of the background of the genesis of those amendments. From my point of view, anyway, that would be helpful. I don't know if that how that fits with the rest of the panel.
I think that might be helpful to all the committee. Why don't you do that?
Okay, let me try and give you a shorthand version of with a little bit of argument, and I apologize for that. Most of the technical changes made in the sections that Mr. Renaud didn't refer to just relate to taking out some old references to the old Senate Bill 10 provisions that are repealed in this law. That'll answer the question for all of you wondering what's going on. When you get to the guidelines question, I think you have to look at it three different ways. First, the statement that's in the Senate Journal from the 1973 session that says guidelines are suggestions, and the argument that's ensued about whether or not they are mandatory in the sense that local government has to show what alternative means they use or show how their alternative means was a better means than the one LCDC suggests at the end of their goal. I think the amendment on page 4, the definition of guideline, resolved that once and for all. You'll notice it does not require any identification of different means or justification for the use of a different means. The change on the membership of the commission. The first one, reflecting geographic and occupational makeup, I guess is fairly clear. It just says it'd kind of be nice with a statewide commission dealing with 270-some jurisdictions that we have a mirror of the state's occupational and geographic makeup.
Occupational being in the very broadest sense of agriculture versus timber versus...
Right, right. There was a word in there at one time, demographic, which suggested sex, race, religion, and a lot of things that would pose some problems on a seven-man commission, seven-person commission. The amendment down at the bottom of the page is known as administrative tailoring, and I think you had the answer that's fairly close to that, but it does make a difference. Originally, LCDC had made out a workbook like that for questions you must answer so they could determine where the devil you are in the planning process. Well, if you give that to Sumter, and at the same time the city of Portland, Sumter with maybe a part-time city clerk is going to have a little tough time going through that workbook and getting it back to LCDC. It was that kind of administrative strain that amendment's addressed to. Page 6, the line about inventories on pages 12 and 13, there are two significant changes there. One is that LCDC is not required to prepare all inventories of land uses, whatever that meant. Secondly, it does mean that they can get others to prepare them. They can use existing soil surveys, for instance, the Soil and Water Conservation Service, and a lot of other things that are available. The other change is that we're no longer talking about inventories of land uses, which at least to the drafter of the bill always meant, you know, what's on the ground right now before you start planning for what you want in the future. This says, in its new context, land use inventories, which can include things like water studies, sewer studies, soil studies, not necessarily what's sitting on the ground right now or what the ground's committed to. Model zoning, I think, is fairly clear. It just says, why make it a mandate? Local government chafes under that mandate. Why not make it an optional power of LCDC? I won't comment on annexation at this time, since I will be testifying on that tomorrow night.
Do you want to go through that issue at all now? You want to wait till the hearing?
Well, I think it'd be unfair.
All right.
Page 9, the business about state agencies and special districts. The original Senate Bill 100 said that state agency and special district must comply with the goals and guidelines. Trouble was, it talked only about comprehensive plans. Department of Transportation may have a six-year plan, but it has no comprehensive plan in the same sense that a city or county has one which incorporates transportation, existing land use, sewer, water, all of the other various factors. And that's why you see changes throughout here that speak to the plan, programs, and regulations of state agencies and special districts. Because theirs is not a comprehensive planning process in the same sense as cities and counties. But the point is, in 73, supposedly they were subject to compliance with the goals and guidelines. This simply says, with the penalty discussed of barring contest to compliance requests, that they have to get with it, and they have to get with it fairly quickly.
Wasn't part of the genesis for this was the fact that DOT said, for all intents and purposes, that they did not have to go through, did not have to be applicable to the local goals, or local planning, I should say?
I think that's one of the considerations. There was quite a bit of comment about whether or not the Department of Transportation or DEQ or any other agency with significant land use impacts from its program had to actually work with a local jurisdiction. To use the worst kind of example in the Department of Transportation, one might say in the city of Medford you have a state arterial going through the center of town, as I recall, state road or state highway, whatever their term. if the Department of Transportation decides it wants to put in a new turnaround area or whatever, does it have to check in the simplest sense the city of Medford? Under this provision, it clearly would. It would be subject to the local comprehensive plan to that extent of involvement and input, especially to the extent that everybody else is subject to that kind of input.
Isn't it true that this is going to have a significant impact on a lot of state agencies because they're going to have to go back and review their plans to see how they apply to the goal?
If they haven't been doing it since 1973 when the requirement was on them, I guess the argument is it's about time they did it.
Have we got indication that they have been doing it?
If I can believe what I hear at the LCDC meeting, the record is spotty. Some have, some haven't. Question of input and coordination more than anything else.
Is the thrust on that on state agency to comply with the local comp plan? In other words, are they in essence going to be through the local coordinator working with the communities, or the communities going to have to go out and start scratching up these people and saying, hey, what's your plan so we can make up our comp plan?
It's going to be a little bit of both, and that's why the law, or that's why this change in the law calls for an agreement to be worked out with LCDC, spelling out what kinds of things they do that impact local government planning and what kinds of resources they have, what kind of staff they have.
The cost of appeal should help, isn't it?
Certainly should.
Just send me a synopsis and return. I'm trying to pick up a few just to show it.
The change is on page 12, the goal definition. If you were in line 17 and again in line 19 to eliminate the word or to change the word shall not be to shall not be substituted for, you would clearly get the meaning of that provision. Goals as general planning standards cannot be used as a substitute for the kinds of regulations that are now clearly made subject to legislative approval. A planning and siting permit program for certain activities, or a general management plan regulation program for a geographic area. And that's just clarifying the distinction that was there in 73. Develops it a little further. But if you use the word shall not be used as a substitute for, I think you get clear meaning of that.
Isn't that clear less than line 19, goals should not be direct regulation of land uses?
I'm not sure I get your question.
Well, doesn't that ambiguity in line 17 clear up with the language in line 19?
No, because if you notice, the objects of both those sentences are either the area in the first sentence or the activity program in the second sentence. Okay. I guess I'm arguing sentence structure to you now, but one says the goal can't be used as a substitute for an area, one can't be used as a substitute for an activity or the kind of things that you can do under those two programs. A goal is a goal. It isn't an area and isn't an activity.
Do we need to clarify that in fact a goal is a state regulation?
I guess I share some of Mr. Herman's comments. I'm not sure what good it would do you. That suggestion was made to the Senate committee. But if you want to get awful technical about it, or philosophical, or both, a goal really isn't a rule either, because in the process of getting it, you have to go through 10 public hearings held throughout the state and a series of other differences from the Administrative Procedures Act. And just to say that a goal is a rule may buy you more trouble than just being silent on it and recognizing the difference in statute. I I guess I'd point out one thing on page 13 in section 20. The compliance schedule was referred to as sort of a mutual agreement. I guess I'd say it is sort of a mutual agreement. But I would point out in line 34 and 35 that the compliance schedule shall remain in effect until the revision has been approved by the commission and the city or the county. So it's maybe a little more mutual than some parties might realize.
Steve, I'm sorry, I'm going to ask you to go back. And a little more mutual than some parties may realize.
You've got a lot of compliance schedules out there right now, which essentially were, not essentially, which the local government may or may not have agreed to point by point. This says that any changes in those compliance schedules or in any new compliance schedule is subject to the approval of both parties, so it puts them on a mutual kind of bargaining relationship. And you can see the tit for tat up in subsection 1 on the top of page 13. I'm trying to find it here. Oh, I'm sorry. It's down in line 22, 2A, where it says the city or county agrees to complete the task list in the compliance schedule in consideration for the commission's agreement to recognize that they're making satisfactory progress while they're on that schedule. That's a significant statement.
Thank you.
I guess on page 18 on the area activity thing, I just point out that if you read through that as opposed to the bracketed material just before each of those two black letter lists, I think you'll see how the ideas of areas and activity have been developed and perhaps given more direction in what it is that we're talking about and what it is that may be brought to you for approval at some later date. On page 23, this is the replacement for Senate Bill 10. I guess my comment is here, there is a Court of Appeals review of an agency decision against the city or county, Representative Markham, but there is one substantial difference in this Court of Appeals procedure. The court in line 11 has the power to modify the LCDC order, as opposed to simply sending it back to LCDC and saying we either reverse, affirm, or remand for further action. The court has the power to modify and put an end to it at that point. And that is an unusual power in terms of APA.
Is that written out here?
Yeah, I just on line 11, page 23, you'll note the word modify, and if you double-check that with 183.484, I think it is, you'll find that that is an unusual power. And I guess the notice provision speaks for itself. That's quickly done.
Questions? Thank you, Steve.
See you tomorrow night.
Right. Jeff, the question has arisen in the committee is the difference between the June 13th memorandum from Chairman Nosser and the May 31st memorandum. I'm wondering if you feel comfortable to mark on that, or would you like to have John Gustafson join you, or?
I'd prefer to have John come up. I was only able to read the cover letter on the June 13th memo and not complete it.
So. All right, fine.
It's in a green packet.
John, could you join us?
Did you round up the extra copies of that?
Yes, I did.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Jefferson, Department of Land Conservation Development. Commissioner Dorothy Anderson is here too to respond to the question about the difference between the memorandum.
I understand, John, that Mr. Mosser intends to testify before the committee tomorrow night, but that Representative Morris and I both wanted to know the distinction between the two. I suppose it's additional information.
I think one of the major differences between the two is that where the original memo had talked about blanket conditions over all jurisdictions, we now really only have the one blanket condition, and that deals with compliance schedules, saying that everybody should be on a compliance schedule, and that they, if any slippage of more than 60 days occurs, then we should be notified. But all of the other conditions that we had talked about originally as being blanket are now discretionary, in the sense that they will be worked out between our staff and the jurisdictions where they are necessary, because we recognize that in many places they are not going to be necessary because either the jurisdiction will be very close to reaching compliance or they will not have any adverse conditions that will need application of these particular standards, what had once been standard. So I think now you might say that they would be all discretionary rather than standard. I think one other major change to me, because I know there was a lot of concern about it last week, was where the geological hazards, the application of that condition on geological hazards, had been, to me, a very vague one also, is now speaking specifically of where those hazards are known to exist through some specific inventory. And again, it's discretionary in that it would only be applied where jurisdictions really would have a particular problem that would need to have it applied. Also, you may notice that instead of talking about beaches and dunes and the shoreline goals individually, there's only one referred to now, and that's the shoreline goals. It was felt that the hazard, the known hazard, would cover the concern with the beaches and dunes, the active four dunes. And the shorelands, we are talking again just about the vegetative cover and the saving of sites for water-dependent uses, so those won't be lost. Again, those would be worked out individually with each jurisdiction where necessary. I think that's really the major change. Also, by the way, even though this was adopted by the commission, it is going to have a chance to be reheard in July. We wanted to get something down so we could start working with it, but all opportunity for further comment has certainly not been cut off.
Fine.
I'd like to get an indication of how much exposure we're going to have that this could become an issue. Let me explain it this way. We came out with Senate Bill 100 in 73, and we said land use planning. And so the community started cranking up to create a comprehensive plan. Several of them have done so, and they've completed it, and it's been approved. Now, you use the term compliance. Is that a term that's used because they have not been on an acceptable time schedule, and therefore an order has been issued that they will follow certain steps within a time frame? Is that how you use the word compliance?
Yes. It's the steps that a jurisdiction has agreed along with the department that are necessary for them to take within a certain time frame in order for them to reach.
Okay, now of all the units of local government that we have, how many of them are having to operate with the compliance schedule? Is it half of them, most of them?
Oh, more than half. It's almost all of them, because there are only, is it six? Let's see. There aren't very many that have reached compliance.
So most of the communities have had to have direction from LCDC through a compliance schedule to help them achieve this goal of a comprehensive plan.
What they have done is the jurisdictions themselves have looked at their own plans and evaluated them in terms of the statewide goals, and then they have developed their own compliance schedules. Our staff has then looked at those compliance schedules to check to see if our staff feels that they do indeed meet the requirements.
Okay, they then have, quote, and I believe the phrase is used in yours or somebody's, evolving comprehensive plan.
We took that out.
I just was getting to learn it.
I'm glad you had problems with
that. Well, whatever you call that, dude. Anyway, we've got a plan that's being structured, a comp plan. And there will be planning actions take place during this period of time that we're coming up with a comp plan. So really, most of the planning actions for many of the jurisdictions will be subject to this memorandum. Is that correct? Have an exposure to be measured by the LCDC directly as to whether in fact they're applying the goals to these individual actions. See, what I'm trying to do is get a breadth of how
yeah,
much...
Yeah, you're trying to get the tie. I'm not sure that I would say that most actions would be, because this covers interim measures on agricultural land. It requires that there be a schedule for the urban growth boundary, but that doesn't control actions. And with known hazards, actions that would take place on those identified known hazard areas, they would have to be protected by an interim measure.
Let's take,
but there are others.
Let's take Al Shaw's favorite town, Roseburg. Are they on a compliance schedule like that?
Yes, I'm pretty sure it is. Mm-hmm.
Okay, now they're having planning actions. They're approving zone changes. In hopefully within the framework of their comp plan. Now, so most of their planning actions could be susceptible to this memorandum and its interpretation of what it says.
I think the only ones that might be affected by this by a city particularly would be if Roseburg had a very active slide area, for example, or a floodplain that was known to be underwater every year or something of that sort, then actions on that particular in that particular area would be affected. Building permits, no, unless they were in a known hazard area for the city of Roseburg.
Well, wouldn't it also mean just building permits for, let's take Fred Vanetta. He suddenly became a building contractor, and he's trying to propose a subdivision in Roseburg, Oregon. And let's say he spots a piece of agricultural land.
Ah, okay. That you brought up a point that I should have made and I didn't. The one on agricultural land only applies to counties. It does not apply to cities. So agricultural land within the city limits would not be affected by this.
Okay, then we'll just change it and make it to Douglas County so we can get in Fred's construction
okay.
show.
Then in the county, if Douglas County would not have its land zoned an EFU by next spring, then it would have to develop an interim procedure which would in essence require that land for be judged against the statewide goals in terms of housing, for example. But before they could put a house on it, they would have to show that would not be contrary to the requirements of Goal 3, which is the protection of agriculture.
Would your local coordinator down there would be measuring Douglas County and their actions to see in fact that Fred's proposal is within the framework of the comp plan that's being constructed. Is that right?
Not necessarily in terms of the comprehensive plan, but in terms of if it's going to be on agricultural land, class 1 through 4 soils.
But he'd be looking at them to make sure that these individual actions, the proposal for Fred's subdivision on agricultural land in Douglas County, he'd be looking at that to make sure that that's staying within the framework of the comp plan that's being constructed. Is that correct? In other words, I'm trying to find out who's going to blow the whistle that Fred's proposed subdivision is bad and shouldn't be because it violates the comp plan that's being constructed.
If it's in an area where the comprehensive plan is probably now suggesting that it would be that the plan hasn't been approved by LCDC, so it is in progress. If that's in an area where the comprehensive plan is suggesting that it would be set aside for agriculture, and it is class 1 through 4 soils, then yes, this would affect.
Who'd blow the whistle? The local, either a citizen or the Thousand Friends of Oregon, or the local coordinator down there of LCDC?
It would probably be a citizen or another jurisdiction.
But it could be the LCDC man in the Roseburg area. Is that correct?
Yes. With this it would be, because he would be checking, the field representative down there would be checking them.
you feel this is going to be a moratorium?
Pardon?
Do you feel this is going to be a moratorium against construction development?
I don't think it is. We're not suggesting that that's the only device to use. Lane County has already come up with another proposal that is not a moratorium. They have a proposal now for what they call unzoned area permits, where they look at their own policies for their county plan, and they're adding to it the Goal 3 requirements against which they will judge proposals that come up in any areas that are yet unzoned.
How about the statement that we're not really balancing the housing and economic development goals? The housing and economic development with the goal, with the activities, goals, what is this? This proposed in housing and economic development.
I think there are probably two responses to that. One of them, again, is the fact that we're not talking about within city limits. The other, again, is that it's discretionary, that it's going to be worked out with the jurisdiction. So that if a jurisdiction has great housing needs or economic problems where housing is necessary, that will be dealt with the individual jurisdiction.
If I could add something to that too, Representative Morris, in the creation of the discretionary conditions, Roman numeral 2, placing of discretionary conditions would come only after consultation with a particular jurisdiction and consideration of its efforts to balance concerns addressed by all the goals. That was inserted by the commission this weekend.
That's on page, that's, give me the Roman numeral number 2.
Roman numeral number 2, first sentence.
It's on the second sheet.
Second sheet.
Okay.
Housing is one of the 19 goals, and the economy of the state is the second of the 19 goals.
Representative Shaw.
Yeah. You use the comprehensive plan and zoning as being the same, if I understood you correctly. For example, let's go to Douglas County again. It's all zoned. We don't have any unzoned land. They don't necessarily, the zoning doesn't necessarily meet with the comprehensive
plan. Yeah, okay. I was using Lane County as an example. Lane County, my own county, is not as ahead as you are because they do have large areas of unzoned land. But of course, the zone should be in Douglas County. Your zone should be in compliance now with your comprehensive plan.
Well, if it isn't, it's awfully close. But it concerns me that you use those two like they were one and the same. You know, in listening to you here, you use the word zoning and you use the word comprehensive plan as if it was all together.
Well, the zoning is to carry out the comprehensive plan. I may have used it in that context. I can't remember now. But
okay,
I said
let's go back to, if I may, Mr. Chairman, let's go back where you said farmland was EFU. That isn't necessarily true. There's different, we have EFU, the exclusive farm use, but then we also have the AG and the I guess it's F1 yet. We have forest recreation, so on. Some of that's ranch land, farmland. All mixed together.
There may be another type of zone that will be acceptable to preserve the land according to the requirements of Goal 3. That's getting into sort of details I'm not sure you want to get into today.
Well, those are the things that tend to be confusing. You talk about zone, you talk about comprehensive plan. Mm-hmm. They're not the same.
No, except the zoning is to carry out the intent of the comprehensive plan, so they should work together.
The point is, if you have a zone that isn't in compliance with the comprehensive plan right now, you got a problem getting a building permit. There's already a moratorium on that, for example. I know I've been sitting on it for a couple of years myself. In one case, saying that, well, we made a mistake. It was supposed to be something else. But trying to undo that or correct that has been something a little bit different.
Further questions from the committee?
I might ask questions.
Representative Martin.
Okay. Could you define what a geological hazard is to me, please? And how many have been defined by the group so far? What you use for a
On page 3, do you have, I don't know, you may not have the memo. In the memo on page 3, which is on the third sheet,
the memo,
the footnotes, they list
the
things that might be covered.
Yes.
Right. And what I was suggesting or saying earlier is that rather than just use this vague list and say stream and ocean flooding, well, you know, it's areas where we know because of inventories and data in existence, we know that this is a hazard because it really is a problem. It's not a you know, some area that maybe once every 100 years has a little bit of a flooding problem, but it's a known hazard area.
Well, if it's a flooding area, is that a geological hazard? Is that what you're telling me?
That's included. Stream and ocean flooding are included in the list, which is in the footnote on page 3.
Is that problem they got down there at Salishan, is that one as an example that you could cite?
Salishan would probably be under...
It's not an ocean hazard or something.
That would be the active foredune.
What you, didn't you mention
it's farther down on the list.
Ocean flooding, that doesn't come under that, huh?
I'm not enough of an expert in that area. It might be a little bit of both. That's what I'm hesitating about, but it's primarily an active
flooding. It's undercutting. It's an ocean, it's an active foredune, but there could be flooding in the case of the Salishan situation, too.
City of Ashbury is an example here. 3 or 4 years ago, I had some houses that were in, some of them did slip. Now, are you people taking it upon yourself to say no more if there happens to be some vacant lots along there, which I do not know if there is or is not? I'm just trying to get a handle on this thing.
Quite to the contrary, it's asking local governments to address those kinds of concerns as they issue the permit.
As they see it, not as you may perceive they should do it. Is that correct?
There to be... If it's a known hazard, they're to be inventorying these locations and scientifically studying to make sure when these difficulties occur, that the kind of construction that comes on is not going to be dangerous.
Are you going to people have geologists out running around the country finding out these things for yourself?
No.
This is already a requirement, of course, for the local jurisdictions when they're developing or improving their comprehensive plans, is to get this sort of information. Some areas are farther along than others. In some cases, they have site-specific inventories, and in other cases, they don't. And if those cases where they have that information is where we're saying you should, or you know that it's a hazard, then you should be protecting that area, not allowing development to go in those areas that would be...
Will you be helping out the Nuclear Fighting Council, or whatever their modern name is, to see whether it ought to be built at Pebble Springs or somewhere else, a nuke plant? Mm-hmm. You get involved in that in your land use planning?
We haven't.
Thank you.
We've got enough problems.
In summary, Mr. Chairman, the changes that were made by the commission during the last week and removed the standard conditions, most all of them except those applying to processes, and replaced them with discretionary conditions. In response to testimony and comments from local government and interested groups, it changed the substantial amount of the language and removed the interim procedures, the implementation procedures from the document that was originally there. So a very substantial amount of change took place, and of course, as Commissioner Anderson said, there will also be opportunities for further changes at the meeting next month.
Fine. Thanks, John. I'm going to recess now. Matter of fact, I think I'll just adjourn the hearing for the day, and we'll have our hearing Tuesday night. And I thank you all for coming. Dorothy, especially thanks to you. Understand the staff being around this day. It's hard work. Thank you very much.